In the first hour of the program today, we will have another conversation with a candidate, one of those that will be involved in March 16th's primary here in Illinois. One of Illinois' senators, Peter Fitzgerald, announced last year that he would not run for re-election. So we have an open seat in the U.S. Senate from Illinois and a crowded field of candidates that would like to secure their party's nomination to run. There are 8 Republicans and 7 Democrats, and we have called all of them and said, if you're interested, we'd like to have you on this program, and we'll try to get as many of them scheduled as we possibly can to give people who listen some access to the candidate and an opportunity to ask questions. That's something that we have tried to do now for over many years when there are elections, give people some candidate access. This morning, we'll be talking with one of the 7 Democrats who would like to get their party's nod to run for the Senate, and his name is Gary Chico. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He has been involved in politics in Chicago for some time. He served as the chief of staff to Chicago Mayor Richard Daley from September of 92 through May of 1995. And before that, he was deputy chief of staff. He was also the general counsel to the Chicago Development Council. In 1995, Mayor Daley appointed him president of the Chicago Board of Education, and he was reappointed in 1999. He has an undergraduate degree from University of Illinois with major in political science and a law degree from Loyola University. He graduated from law school there in 1985. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Also, I guess maybe one interesting feature I want to mention, too, if he is elected, he would be the first Hispanic U.S. senator in almost 3 decades. Questions are certainly welcome. You can give us a call and talk with our guest, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Any place else in the state of Illinois, if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Mr. Chico, hello.
Yes. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Good. Good. Good to be with you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Sure.
What do you want to run for Senate?
I want to run for the United States Senate because I've been fortunate enough to experience what government that is producing can do for people. As president of the Chicago School Board, I took over a school system that was absolutely horrendous, and we made it work to serve children and their families again. Prior to that, with Mayor Daley as his chief of staff, we were able to make the city of Chicago function a whole lot better by doing such things as revitalizing our neighborhoods through infrastructure investment and providing more police on the street and reducing business taxes to make for a more hospitable climate for businesses. So I've experienced what government and action servicing people can be, and I think we can get a lot better production out of the United States Senate to help the people throughout Illinois that I visited for the last year and a half. I mean, people are hurting, and they need help.
Well, there are a number of basic issues that I'd like to raise, and of course, when and if we have callers, we'll just get those people right in, and
sure,
they can ask about whatever they want. But let me just raise one thing that the first thing that you touched on, and it certainly connects with your experiences involved in the school board and with education. I want to ask you what you think about the legislation that is generally called No Child Left Behind.
Yes.
The president, that was one of the things when he was running, he said he was concerned about education. A lot of people nowadays use the word accountability all the time. And what this legislation does is it says to schools, you need to set standards for your kids, and then you need to test them to make certain that they're meeting those standards. And then assistance to aid to the schools is tied on whether or not they meet their goals. And I know that there are a lot of educators that have concerns about whether or not this is the right way to go. What do you think about No Child Left Behind?
Well, I have a lot of difficulty with No Child Left Behind because of several flaws in the legislation. First of all, President Bush calls this his single greatest domestic achievement. But I can't figure out for the life of me why you would call something that and then yourself in your own budget ask for $9.5 billion less than Congress authorized to support the act. What that means is that for the mandates called for in the act, the burden on local school systems has got to be paid for with strictly local money. That comes with extra data gathering, extra reporting, transportation to deal with schools that are viewed to be failing, and I think that that's a real flaw. So what I've done is go around the state of Illinois, talking to people, superintendents, principals, teachers. We've had roundtables in Peoria, Quincy, the Quad Cities. And I've gathered up a great deal of opinion about what changes ought to be made to the law, and I've offered them up in the form of several amendments. One, let's fully fund No Child Left Behind. Let's get that $9.5 billion today behind that law because it helps school systems throughout the country, three-quarters of which in Illinois are underwater today, I might add. Two, the definition of a failing school is flawed. Here's what it says. If a subgroup of as little as 40 students does not meet state standard as outlined by our state statutes, our state rules, then as many as 1,000 other students in that same school can be painted with the brush of failure, even though the other 960 students may have done just perfectly fine on their exams. Well, that's wrong because it's unfairly painting a picture of failure when it's in fact not the case. So I would say that definition needs to be changed. There's a definition called adequate yearly progress in the federal law, which says that every school child in this country ought to meet their state standards in reading and math by 2014. Now, that's a mere 10 years away. There is no way in the world that this nation's student population, as much as we would like it, is going to be performing exactly at their state standard, because it's impossible. These are human beings. Now, is it a great aspiration to have? Of course it is. The problem with this law is it imposes strict and current real consequences for not meeting that kind of a curve toward everybody complying with state standard in 10 years. And then finally, if a school is truly failing, there are schools, God only knows, I have experience from Chicago of seeing entire schools that need to improve. The remedy isn't to offer a transportation voucher and get out of there. The remedy is to roll up your sleeves and get in there and try to fix the broken school. Sometimes it's leadership, the principal, sometimes it's curricular, sometimes it's resource related, but that's the way you get in there, and that's the way you make changes to better children's lives. I want to add one more thing. As I put together these amendments, I contacted the former Secretary of Education, U.S. Secretary of Education, Richard Riley. I contacted the Illinois Principals Association, the Illinois Association of School Boards, and the Illinois School Administrators Association, and they all support these amendments that I've proposed to make No Child Left Behind work to serve as children, not just simply penalize them and act like and make it seem as though we're doing something federally to assist education.
We have a caller ready to go to talk with our guest, and I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Gary Chico. He is one of seven Democrats that will compete in the March primary, March 16th, here in Illinois. Mm-hmm. One of them then will go on to represent their party in the general election for the United States Senate. This is the seat that's now held by Peter Fitzgerald. He's not running again, and there are a lot of candidates. There are seven, as I said, seven Democrats and eight Republicans who will be involved in the primary, and we'll have as many of them on this show as we can so you can talk with them. We do have one caller here ready to go in Urbana, and we'll do that. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my question is on jobs. You know, I keep reading in the paper about these sweatshops over in China or Asia, mm-hmm. where they are forcing people to work, you know, under really intolerable conditions, you know, to produce articles that show up in malls all over the country. And now, of course, the U.S. labor really can't compete with that. I'm just wondering, did you have any specific ideas as to how you might redress that when and if you got to the Senate?
I do, and I think your question is an excellent one because I think that's the burning issue of the day, right there with health care. The issue is this. The United States of America, and this is an impulse and a gut reaction that we'd like to have as Americans, appreciates free trade. I mean, that's been a long part of our history in this nation. The problem is this. Over the course of our 200-year history, our economy and its workers have evolved to a certain standard of living that is quite high when measured across the world. And when you take the maturity that we've been able to see in our wages, our environmental regulation, our worker safety regulations, and you compare that with the situation in developing nations like China, like India, like Mexico, there is a vast disadvantage that the American worker faces in trying to compete with those other locales. So what do we do about it? I've offered up a following approach to how we should look at trade going forward. We should not enter into any kind of trading agreement with a nation that doesn't observe a certain set of standards or a floor, if you will, in a minimum wage, a set of environmental regulations, and a set of worker safety regulations. For example, the Chinese, I was just out at a plant the other day, Western Suburbs, that makes appliances, and that plant is showing me photos of a Chinese factory which has their very appliance being deconstructed to be re-engineered for a lower cost. But here's the kicker. The Chinese worker is probably making 30 to 35 times less than the American counterpart. Now, unless the United States wants to continue to just allow this action to take place on an unfettered basis, we are going to continue to see an absolute hemorrhaging of jobs. The U.S. ought to say to anybody, let me be clear about this, the U.S. ought to say to any country that wants to trade with us that unless you observe a certain set of standards which more or less tries to level the playing field, we have no interest in trading with you. Because it's real nice to say developing nation and put that label on a country, but basically all it means to the American corporation that's looking for the absolute least cost alternative, go there, make your money there, and forget about the American worker. We can use, my view is very simple, where is American corporate patriotism? I don't hear about it, I don't see it. It seems like we just basically close our eyes to concepts of offshoring, where, you know, now IBM just talks about this with impunity. Now we're going to put 5,000 jobs over in India. We're going to put 5,000 jobs in China without a flinch. I think that's wrong. And I frankly think where the debate has to start on this and where the correction needs to start on this is in the White House. I would hope that President Bush and this administration, I'm being more rhetorical here than I am sincere because I don't see it coming. It would be nice if the President of the United States began this dialogue with American corporations to say, look, what are we going to do here? We cannot continue to go down the path of just shifting our jobs to all developing nations and forget about the American worker. The dislocation and the transitional impact in the U.S. of people going from one industry to be possibly retrained and relocated in another industry is a cataclysm, and we cannot tolerate it any longer. So what actions are you going to take, corporate executive, to try to make things a little bit better here in America? And there's several things that we can do. We just talked for a minute about trade policy, but there's things you can do with the United States tax code to make it more attractive for American corporations to locate their next plant here domestically. I mean, for example, in my own website, www.garychicoforsenate.com, I offer up some very specific worker tax credit ideas, which is a tax credit offered to a corporation based on the number of workers they hire. I mean, I think that's a good way to compete and compete with people right now that have a gross advantage over our present state of affairs because of the much cheaper labor and other lesser environments for environmental regulation and worker safety.
A potential President Kerry has said that he's going to hold these Benedict Arnolds accountable.
And he ought to.
And because it seems Wall Street is the one that's making the money.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you raise another excellent point. The fact that the United States stock market goes over or under 10,000 points, you know, what relevance is that to the average American worker? I mean, unless it's affecting their 401k to some extent. But as far as wages go, security in their job, if anything, there's probably a negative correlation. And I think that John Kerry, but I also think it's the responsibility of the U.S. Congress, has got to start to step up and talk about U.S. corporate patriotism. And frankly, we don't even hear the subject discussed today. But I'll tell you one thing. This administration is very aggressive about telling you and me to wear our American flag, go to war where they tell us to go to war, and basically pay the taxes we're told to pay.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for the call.
Just to take this just one step further, you know, just recently we had marked the 10-year anniversary of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Mm-hmm. At the time NAFTA was passed, people raised these same issues, issues about what kind of working conditions were there for workers, particularly in Mexico, and their wages, and also addressed the issue of things like their ability to organize, and then the environmental issues. And at the time, people were advocating NAFTA, said, well, we're going to negotiate these agreements, these side agreements, and we're going to address those things. And it seems that that hasn't really happened. Some people would ask, you know, if we can't make that happen with this country with which we've entered into this trade agreement, how are we going to make it happen with another country like China?
Well, I have a unique theory on this. You change the players. Look, NAFTA was brought to us by the Democrats, And I'm going to tell you something. I have been one of the first in line to say, I've been to more forums involving Democrats than I can shake a stick at, where people just say, all we need to do is get a Democrat in that seat. Wrong. This is not about just electing a Democrat. It's about electing somebody who happens to be a Democrat, who's going to have the courage to do the right thing. And that means, on occasion, even opposing their own party if it means benefiting the American worker. NAFTA was wrong. We should have seen this coming. Who in the world could not have figured out that a wage differential between the Mexican worker and the American worker, which is 15 to 25 times apart, would not lead to a gross advantage for the Mexican worker in terms of American corporations locating their operations in that country, just like we saw Maytag do recently by pulling up stakes in Galesburg and taking their operation to Reynoso. Now, I say to you that those side letters and many of the weak provisions in NAFTA have proven that we cannot conduct our trade negotiations along those lines. We need trade agreements with teeth, and that's the way they have to be handled. But we have to be careful, because it was President Clinton and his administration and people appointed by him that led the way to NAFTA. Now, I'm not going to say that Bill Clinton was poorly motivated. I just think that experience has shown us now that that cannot be the template for further trade agreements. Something has to be done radically different, and I think that I've offered up some ideas today about how I would conduct trade negotiations and some of the principles that I would lay on the table at the very outset before a country even comes to us to want to trade with us.
All right, let's talk with someone else. The next caller is in Champaign on line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hey, while we're waving the corporate patriotism flag, I'd like you to do something for me. I'd like you to reach around and look at the label on your undershirt and the label on your shirt and the label on your pants and tell us all where this stuff was made.
Bingo. You raise an excellent point. There used to be a period of time in America where we were very proud to, quote, buy American. American made. We used to have those labels. We used to have those signs put on goods that we would buy. I mean, I try to do my part as much as I can with automobiles and with other goods. I try to see where they're made, where they're coming from. I'm not enamored with the Walmarts of the world, who want to have some person show up on a television commercial wearing that blue vest, and then everything purchased from the stores around the world at the cheapest price possible. I think you raise an excellent point. We can use another dose of Buy American. I think that's part of, but I don't think that's the exclusive strategy we should adopt. I think it's part of an overall strategy to try to get our footing back here as we compete on the world stage. And you couldn't be more right about that. But I think it's a part of a larger strategy to make America more competitive again.
May I suggest that some of you, the candidates adopt the position that maybe we ought to be exporting unionism and raising the rates of the people we're competing against so that, we are on a level field.
Well, your point is where I come out. Here's what I feel about this. Whether it's unionism or not, the American worker, because of our evolution in our economy, is far more mature vis-a-vis the world counterparts in most places of the world. Which means that the answer to that lies not in going backwards and taking a person who's making $65,000 down to $42,000. The answer lies in bringing up the standard of living of other parts of the world. I'll tell you why.
Exactly.
Every time I look at somebody who picks up stakes and goes to another country where workers are making 30 times less, I never see it come back to the consumer in the form of a lower price. Do you?
Well, one can make the case that prices would be higher if they stayed. However, the underlying point I wanted to make was, really, we need to talk about bringing up the rest of the world,
yes,
not
sir,
forcing us to pay higher prices.
I'm with you. I think that's an excellent point.
All right. Thank you for the call. President Bush has proposed a program that would give illegal immigrants here in the United States temporary worker status. If they were sponsored by their employers, they could stay for 3 years.
Yeah.
People who live outside the country could apply for that status, but there are some limitations. They can't bring their families, and there's no provision for those folks eventually to become citizens.
Right.
Essentially, what he's talking about is creating a guest worker program for the United States.
Right.
What do you think about that?
I do not endorse that concept for the following reasons. If you take the estimate that there are between 8 to 12 million undocumented workers in the United States today, and that there is about average 143,000 green cards issued, you can see that what happens to the worker after 3 years and one day. Many people who will have identified themselves, their address, and their employer are going to go completely at risk and be subject to deportation. Now, all I can say to you is this. People come to the United States. Remember, about 50% of that number is from Mexico and countries to the south, and others are from around the world. So we're not talking about an exclusively Latin phenomenon, just so we know that. So we're talking about people from Poland, Asia, other countries as well. Are we going to be just deporting people in the most massive number we've ever seen in humankind? I hope not, because of two things. People have come to this country because of the basic human impulse to want to do better for themselves and do better for their families. That impulse is not going away after 3 years. Also, we have to keep in mind the employer side of this equation. You know, employers are just as much of a part of this issue as the employee. People are hiring people who they think are good workers at whatever prices they are negotiating or are willing to pay them. But these workers serve as the underpinning for entire industries, whether it be construction, whether it be housekeeping, whether it be, agriculture, whether it be, landscape maintenance, things of this nature. What is going to restaurant industry? What's going to happen to these industries if in 3 years and one day the deportations start to set in? I think the person, oddly enough, for me, who offers guidance on this issue is President Ronald Reagan. President Ronald Reagan in 1986 offered what was called at that for an amnesty program. And what I think ought to happen is we ought to use a path toward legalization. Path toward legalization, which allows people to apply for some kind of permanent residency or citizenship over the long term. That's what Ronald Reagan saw in his heart and had compassion to do in 1986, and I think we ought to do that again. It would be the better course of action so that we don't have tremendous employee and employer dislocation. One other thing, people have asked me about this issue before, and people have said, well, don't you think this is rewarding lawbreakers? And I said, look, if Ronald Reagan could come to terms with this and see it as the right human thing to do, then I think I certainly can, and I think others should too. But also, let's remember this. I don't believe that we ought to go through, whether it's amnesty or legalization, once every generation, because that kind of makes a mockery out of the situation. What we ought to do at the same time that we're offering some kind of permanency or legalization is work a little bit harder to make the economic conditions in the countries from which those workers are coming better, and not through NAFTA. I'm talking about negotiating with countries like Mexico to do a better job of offering a path for their own workers from school into entry-level positions, where the country shows more of its own gross domestic product, going into worker training, and things of that nature, so that people have a little bit more incentive to stay in their own country.
We are at our midpoint here, and we have some other callers. We'll get right to them. I do just very quickly want to reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Gary Chico. He's a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate from Illinois, one of seven Democrats that will compete in the primary here on March 16th, and one of them will go on to represent their party in the general election. We're here on the program having as many candidates, both Democrats and Republicans, as many as we can, so you'll have the opportunity to actually talk with them. He is a former president of the Chicago Board of Education. Before that, served as chief of staff to Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. Questions are welcome, and we have now the lines full, so we'll get right onto it and go next to Belgium, Illinois, which is over near Danville on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to bring up the topic of the primary system as it is, particularly the Democratic primary that's going on right now. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the Democratic primary position is very, very flawed in that we have a group of candidates to choose from. But now through, 12, 15 of these primaries, we're already winrowed it down to one, maybe two. Wouldn't it be better if it was a national primary and we could all select from all the possible candidates?
You're talking about the presidential primary.
Yes, I'm talking about the presidential right now, yes.
Well, I don't know, Mr. Chico, you can. That's a little off of what we're doing here, but if you want to talk about that, you certainly can.
Well, I have an opinion about it. I frankly think that Illinois is too late in the cycle to have any real meaning in participating in the selection of of the either party, by the way, because we hold the Republican and the Democratic Party on the same day. I would like to see, I guess the caller is suggesting that we might want to look at a national schedule which puts us all on the same footing. That's not a bad idea. One would, I mean, you'd certainly have to figure out some logistical challenges, like how do the candidates campaign among 50 states, all for the purpose of getting themselves known to voters, although I guess we do that in the general election on the same day in November.
Yes, sir.
So I'm not sure that it's a bad idea. I know one thing for sure. Illinois has to move up its position in the schedule of selecting a nominee, or it's going to basically find itself irrelevant.
Yeah, it seems though right now, after the first one or two, the news media has decided who we're going to have for president.
Well, sir, you hit on a question that I want to talk about that I think is absolutely powerful. And here's the point. You recall that Howard Dean, we were told by the media that Howard Dean was the person. He was ahead in Iowa about 3.5 to 4 weeks before the Iowa caucus over John Kerry by 26-7. And people were basically from the Dean camp telling John Kerry, you got to get out of the race. You're going to hurt this gentleman. He is obviously the nominee. A mere 3.5 to 4 weeks later, the results of the Iowa caucus show us that John Kerry beat Howard Dean 2-1. Now, what that tells me is this. Nobody should be telling anybody anything until the first voter has cast an actual vote. That's my problem with polls and pundits. I have enormous faith in the people. And by the way, that's up or down. If the people decide that I'm not their candidate, that's fine. We live with it. That's the system we have. Life goes on. But it is an absolute outrage to have media, pundits, pollsters telling us who our leaders are going to be. I'll live by your word and your judgment, but not by some paid pundit.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go back here to an Urbana caller. Next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'm interested in knowing your guest position on making Spanish an official language of the United States. That means we would have two official languages, Spanish and English. I do not want to see happen in this country what I see happening in France, in Canada, when they have English and France,
right.
Excuse me, English and French as an official language, and how that has split that country.
Uh-huh.
I'm most definitely in favor of the Spanish parents teaching their children their language, their history, their culture, and pride in their ethnicity. But if they live in this country, I think they should learn English. It is to their advantage. English is the most widely spoken language in the world, and they would be better prepared as they go around the world if they know English. Also, they would have a better job, better chance of getting a good job in this country. So what is your position on making Spanish an official language?
Mr. Chico? I think we lost the guest. We'll hang on here, and we'll get back to the guest in just a moment, I'm sure, and we'll take other callers as well. This is a part of a series of programs that we have decided we wanted to do in the lead-up to the primary, and we've done this now for many years before primaries and general elections because we think it's a good idea for voters to be able to have some personal contact with the candidates. And be able to ask whatever questions they want. So a couple weeks ago, we started making calls to the candidates, and there are a lot of them. As we said, there are 7 Democrats, 8 Republicans, and said, we have the show. Would you like to be a guest? And some of them immediately took us up on the offer, and others have said they would think about it. So now, between now and March 16th, we're going to do everything we can to have as many of these candidates on the show as possible. All of these people who are running for the Senate, we also do have a primary in one of the congressional districts here in our area, so we've invited the candidates there. And we want to try and give you some personal access, so that's the idea. People in the media get to talk with the candidates all the time and ask them questions, but voters don't often get that kind of access. So that's what we have tried to do here on the program now for many, many years. So we hope that people will take advantage of that, not only listen, will call in if they have questions. And again, here, our guest this morning is Gary Chico. He is one of the seven Democrats that will be competing with one another in the primary in March. This is March 16th. And then one of them will go on to represent the party, the Democratic Party, in the race for the United States Senate from Illinois. This is the seat that's now held by Peter Fitzgerald. He's a Republican, and he announced last year that he was not going to run for re-election. We've touched on a number of issues here, but we have about probably a good 25 minutes left in the program, and this is the opportunity for people who are listening to call in and ask about whatever issue they consider to be most important. The number here, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Just bear with us here. We've had a little interruption. We're really not quite sure what happened. We lost the guest, but we're getting him back lined up again, and as soon as we do that, we'll get right back to the program. Maybe just real quickly, I can tell you about what's coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine. It's not that long until the tax filing deadline, April 15th. Now, that's just a couple of months away. And on the Afternoon Magazine now for a number of years, they have had accountants, CPAs on the program so that people can ask questions. And they'll be doing one of those kinds of shows today. They'll have two tax experts to answer questions about filing federal income taxes. The guest will be Marty Verdick and Steve Winterstein of the Tax Department of RSM McGladrey Incorporated. They will be joining Celeste Quinn. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. So get out your form. If you've got questions, get out your forms, take a look at them. And I know the two guests will do their best to give you an answer. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. A little bit later, she'll be talking with the author of a book that looks at the history of the Apollo Theater in Harlem, a place that has always been a very popular venue for a lot of different kinds of musicians going back a long time. So that's the Afternoon Magazine. That's at noon here on AM 580. Celeste Quinn is the host. Well, I think we have once again established our connection here with our guest, Jerry Chico. You there,
Hi,
Mr.
David.
Chico?
Sorry for that technical problem.
Sure. Well, did you hear the question of the caller?
No. Can you repeat
asked. It? Asked. Yes. The caller was very concerned about any move that might make Spanish one of the official languages of the country. With English. She makes the argument that it's very important for everyone to learn English. It's widely spoken around the world. It's important not only for people who are here going to live in this country, but perhaps going to be traveling overseas. And so she wants to know what you think. Would you, for example, support a move to make Spanish and English both official languages? Would you support one of those efforts that some people have advocated that says English should be the language of the United States and that's that? Mm-hmm. What do you think about the language issue?
Well, I have no intention to change anything about the English predominance of the United States. I mean, our business, our television, our schooling is all done in the English language, and I have no intent to change that. I think it would be, it is not realistic, however, to understand that people from around the world come here with their own language, and I'm not going to do anything that seeks to rule that out either. I have no move afoot to make any other language the official language of the United States, but I think we all also have to recognize that this country is made up of people from around the world. I mean, as president of the Chicago Public School System, I think we had 56 languages spoken by our students, and therefore, while we gave all examinations and instruction primarily, I mean, even in the bilingual education program, the objective was to have a competency in English. I mean, that's where my head's at. Yeah. But I also don't want to establish any ironclad rule that nobody can speak anything but English. I mean, I think that's wrong. And that really is, not very respectful of the history of our country.
All right. Well, let's get on to some other callers. Thank the last one. And let's go to someone else in Urbana. This is line number 2. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Two questions I had. One is you had mentioned in your earlier remarks, and you may have actually mentioned this, and I'm sorry if you did, and I just was unable to catch a couple minutes of your discussions. Do you believe that health care is a right and not a privilege in this country? And what would you do about it? And the second question is, there's at the state level right now, there's a piece of legislation called the Healthcare Justice Act, which is a state and federal partnership to begin moving Illinois towards affordable, accessible health care for everyone in the state. And do you support that?
I'm not familiar with all the terms of the state act that you cite, but in concept I do. I do believe that health care is a fundamental human right, and this country ought to observe that. The question is how to get there. I've proposed that the United States Congress, because this is such an important issue, and I think we're in crisis in health care in America today, because this is such an important issue, we ought to devote a special session of the United States Congress or create a standing separate committee to fashion suggestions about how to provide every American with health care. And secondly, and here's just as an important issue, affordable health care. The single greatest threat, in my view, to what you and I probably have coverage, I hope you do, I know I do, but it's the cost. I mean, every year I have to shudder at the thought of how much more I'm going to pay, how much more of my coverage is going to be taken away, how much more the universe of providers is going to shrink, and I don't think that's right. I mean, we have got to confront this issue head on, because we do not presently have the mindset, with 44 million Americans uncovered, that health care is a fundamental right. I believe it is such. My hope would be that through such a special session of Congress, we could get to the point where we say, one, give greater incentives to American employers who aren't presently providing the health benefit to do so. Two, to the extent we don't get employers to provide the benefit, we look at other measures like allowing Americans to buy into Medicare, even if they're under 65, if they have any means whatsoever to purchase insurance. And three, to the extent that we don't cover the entire uninsured population that way, we offer up a government-sponsored program, which is, if need be, free to anybody who is not within the Medicaid population but still uncovered. So I view it as something that has to be taken on with a sense of urgency. But I'm going to tell you this, too. I've been on the campaign trail now for a year and a half, and many people pull out a flashy plan from their pocket and call it WWW Health USA, whatever it is. The country is not of a mind right now to simply pass a plan. The environment and the stage needs to be set in Washington to appreciate the urgency and the condition that most people are suffering from. And once we do that, you're going to see this go very, very quickly, and we will get coverage for every American.
Let me ask you about prescription medication costs, because I think now that's one of the leading concerns that people have. Mm-hmm. Is there something that the federal government can do, or should the federal government do something about the cost of prescription medicines?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. There are several problems that can be addressed immediately with also an approach toward the longer term. First, immediately. The lobbyists of the pharmaceutical industry are outrageous, and they are basically, in my view, a cancer on the scene that need to be dealt with. For them to have the kind of power that they wield to cause language to be included in the recent senior citizen Medicare drug prescription measure that says the United States government is not able to negotiate prices with the companies downward is an absolute crime that needs to be addressed and addressed quickly. That's how powerful that lobby is. Secondly, looking at the longer-term horizon, through such a special session of Congress, I would force the pharmaceutical companies to open their books and explain their practices about how they're handling medications and the marketing of medications to Americans in this nation. If you look at it this way, going back to the previous caller's question, I do view health care as a fundamental right, and therefore I view medications to support my health care, my health, and make me better as part of that fundamental right. If that's the case, then we have to give this area special scrutiny and special treatment, because buying your medication to control a heart problem or to treat HIV or cancer is not the same thing as taking a vacation, buying a car, buying a pair of jeans, or even going to the restaurant, because those things are almost purely discretionary, and people have the ability to decide whether to do them or not. Your health is not of that category. Therefore, we ought to, my thought would be that, you know, I'd like to know why the pharmaceutical companies enjoy a net profit margin on the average of about 25-26%, and vaunted American corporations like Coca-Cola, which have been around for years, enjoy a 4% profit margin. Now, why do they have 6 and 7 times greater profit margin in the pharmaceutical industry than in other industries in the Fortune 500? I want to force them to open their books, explain themselves, justify their actions, and I believe what you're going to see through that exercise is that there are certain measures we need to take. I'll give you one example. You watched the Super Bowl recently, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see major advertising by pharmaceutical companies on all kinds of medications, and you and I can't even go to the store and buy those. We at best can go to our physician, and they all say, ask your doctor. By the time you've gone to ask your doctor, the pharmaceutical rep industry has gotten to your doctor, put the coupon in their pocket, and said, if you write the 100th prescription for this brand-name drug, you and your spouse are going to Mexico on us. This system is wired, and it needs to be dewired. And I think that's what this special session will help us get at, while it's also giving us the environment to anger enough Americans to cause some changes to be made by offering coverage to every American.
We'll go on. Next caller is in Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Yeah, it's fun listening to this. The when you were talking about trade, say, and you were talking about things you would do in that area, sounded to me as if you'd be quite willing to take away the only incentives that are very avaricious and greedy financial markets even consider in trying to put investments into the developing world. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of unfair to let you go without you're being asked to at least drop the other shoe here.
I don't think your question's a bad one at all. I mean, the question is, should we allow pure capitalism and market-driven impulse to control the way we invest dollars around the world? That's the question. I mean, shouldn't we allow Wall Street just to put its money wherever it wants? For me, the answer is no. I'll tell you why. Kathy Lee Gifford, just a short time ago, was exposed for paying sweatshop wages to people in developing nations to sell her product at everyday American prices here in the United States. You know, there comes a point at which, look, I'm a capitalist and I appreciate the market. I live by it most of my life. But I'm also telling you this. Markets don't have compassion. Markets do not respect what happens to American workers when they go through retraining and transition to find another job in an industry that may not exist. That's where government comes in sometimes. Government is supposed to have a heart. Even George Bush talks about compassionate conservatism. And I really believe that, no, I'm not here to tell Wall Street what to do, but I would hope that, and there is a movement that's growing, sir, with people like Nell Minow who want what they call corporate responsibility. I mean, I'm not saying that people shouldn't invest wisely and make money as a fiduciary for the people that give them and trust money to them to invest. I mean, that's something that has to be done. But can't we strike somewhat of a balance so that we're not simply funding a race to the bottom around the world? I mean, we are going to hurt Americans by doing this. And I think that investors can still make a very reasonable return on their money. At the same time, we're also trying to invest in bettering the rest of the world.
Oh, I think that's hard to believe. I think it would just go on just the way it is. But actually, I really wanted to know about something else you said.
Sure.
You mentioned your reservations about the No Child Left Behind law.
Yes.
And you mentioned the number 40. I was wondering if that's, before I get on to my question, is that some sort of Illinois law that has to reach the size of 40 before?
That's the smallest. That is the number that meets the threshold of a subgroup, which is called out by the federal law for which an entire school's performance can be judged.
Mm.
In other words, if you have, and what happens is the federal law calls out the performance of subgroups as something to be looked at to determine the entire performance of a school. For example, a 40-person subgroup of limited English speakers, a 40-person subgroup of special education students can be enough to trigger your performance of the entire school under the federal law. That's where that comes from.
Yeah, I didn't know there was such a number as 40 involved, but I'm Latino myself, and in our local high school, there are less than 40 Latinos there, and yet they're, like, say, they're drop their dropout rate is quite high, and I would like the school to put some attention to that. And I think it's a good thing that the NCLB would do that. And
yes.
Let me ask more specifically, though.
I agree with you, by the way, on that.
Yeah, what's your thinking about the dropout rate in general? That's a big problem with Latinos all over the country, and in particular in Chicago. It's even a problem in Mexico itself.
Yes, no doubt about it. Let me just make one brief comment about what you said prior. I don't for a minute, and you know, if anybody looks at my history on the website and looks at my resume, they'll see I'm not short on accountability. I've taken some measures while president of the Chicago School Board that make us very accountable for what we're doing. But to your question about the dropout problem, of course that's an issue. That is a very, very serious issue. Some populations suffer a higher dropout rate than others. African Americans have the highest dropout rate according to State Board of Education statistics, and Latinos are in the second category. What do we do to address these problems? I think each group requires different treatment. My own experience as a Mexican American has been from Chicago to see that many times it is a language issue. I mean, people come to this country as a new immigrant. They get discouraged by not being able to understand the language and progress quickly enough in school, and they get turned off and they drop out. You couple that many times with family cultural pressures where there's a desire to gain income from kids who are 15, 16, 17, who are able to work and bring money into the family. You also many times, unfortunately, in cities like Chicago, you can have a gang issue that gets in the way of somebody, willingly going to school. So I think that you have to dissect the problem, you have to diagnose the problem, and then try to put in place as much as you can to make it better. I'll give you an example. In Chicago, we created what was called an alternative network of schools for dropouts. I'll tell you one thing, a lot of people that do drop out pay the piper and realize the error of their ways down the road, and we offered them a chance to get back into school and get their diploma. And, you know, I think you have to look at this problem in a very flexible way and try to treat it with everything you could possibly muster. But one thing we can't do is this, and this is something I feel very strongly about. The dropout problem is a real one. It's large, but we should never take all of our full time and attention and just look at the problem and neglect all of the people, the 80% of the people that do come to school every day looking for a good education. That's also our responsibility, too.
We have one more caller here, and I want to try to get him in Urbana, okay. Line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, sir.
My question has to do with equality.
Yes.
And the Massachusetts court has stated that anything less than marriage of same-sex couples would not be equal. However, our governor, even though he has voiced his support for same-gender-loving couples to have equal rights, he said he personally does not support gay marriage, and there's discussion in both legislative bodies, the state and the federal, to amend the Constitution. I was wondering, where do you stand on this issue of equality?
Chicago Tribune recently issued questionnaires to all the Democrats in the race and asked what your position is on same-sex marriage. And as I gave my stock answer that I've been giving for a year and a half, I thought the other candidates would be right there with me, but it turned out not to be the case. The Tribune said, the headline read, Chico set apart on issue of gay marriage. I support gay marriage, and I'll tell you why. I'm a lawyer, and I understand the role of the Constitution. The Constitution says that people should be given equal protection of the law. My view is this. Marriage, which comes to us from state statute in Illinois, that's what makes it official and legal in Illinois, is something that, in my view, in my reading, in my understanding of the Constitution, we should not make a determination or discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. That's my legal view of the matter, and therefore I don't see a reason or a justification to deny same-sex couples the benefits of marriage, like inheritance, like tax treatment, things of that nature, rearing of children. And one more thing I have to tell you, and this is something that's more personal. As president of the Chicago Public Schools, when I used to walk the neighborhoods of this city, I saw way too many children that were the product of a perfect heterosexual relationship that had no love, no care, and no guidance. And therefore, if I saw a same-sex couple that wanted to rear a child, you know what? I say, hallelujah. We need more love and we need more care and guidance for our kids, because that is a huge problem that a lot of our cities are facing with children not being cared for well enough in their upbringing.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, I think that we're just about the point that we're going to have to finish. Is there anything real quick you'd like to add to folks before we go?
David, I just want to say that I'm sorry I'm not there with you in person. I am a U of I grad. My daughter is a freshman at the University of Illinois, Sarah at Champaign. And I have very, very fond memories of going to school there. I'm a member of the U of I Alumni Board. And, you know, I hope that your listeners will give us a real good look and look at our website, www.GaryChicoForSenate.com, and give us their support on March 16th. It's a vote for substance.
All right. Well, Mr. Chico, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Thanks for the time.
All right. Our guest this morning in this hour, Gary Chico. He is one of seven Democrats that will be competing in the March 16th primary, and then one of them will go on to represent their party in the general election for U.S. Senator here from the state of Illinois. And as I said, we will continue to have as many candidates as we possibly can on between now and the primary to give you the chance to talk with them.